experience, and we need all of your perspectives from libraries, departments, centers, every aspect of it in order to sort of make this work. And appreciate your taking your time to do this. We appreciate you taking your time to do this.
Second, thanks to NH
for funding our symposium with a Digital Humanities Startup Grant. We have an NEH representative here, tucked back in the corner, Jason Ruddy. And it's interesting because I've been told that it was not easy to get this symposium funded because the higher-ups thought that this wasn't about the humanities. But somehow the reviewers, Brett and Jason, and the rest of the crew convinced them that this was not only important work but timely and innovative, which I think we would all agree is the case. And over the next 2 days, we'll become painfully and exuberantly aware of all of this as we tackle some thorny academic, institutional, and personal issues. Third, I want to thank MIP for hosting us and my own program, DCC, and the director, Matt Kirschenbaum, for granting me the time to participate. You know, there are other places on campus we could probably do this that might be a little bit larger, but MIP is home, and we're used to it, and there's a lot of conveniences here, and so we welcome you here, and thank you to MIP for hosting us. I'd also like to thank Doug, who's been a great collaborator, thoughtful and passionate about these issues, and yet still able to occasionally break into song or dance, which is what he will apparently be doing a lot in his new position as king of the world. What is it?
Digital curator of the performing arts.
Digital king of the world.
Yeah, right.
Digital king of dance. At New York Public Library. And finally, thanks to Chris Grogan, who, if
not
you have
dance,
not
performing arts, but yeah, thank you.
Yeah, so if you haven't met Chris Grogan, she's our business manager here at MIP, and she's made a lot of these logistics possible. And you'll want to know her name as you do reimbursements. I have a form for everybody for reimbursements that's mostly filled out. It says to mail it to Chris. So I'm going to pass these out now just to sort of get this out of the way. You'll want to send Chris your original receipts for travel.
Can I get reimbursed for my mileage?
Sure, Matt.
Is it 9.2?
I've got a quarter on me.
Okay.
This is
food.
The travel, not, oh, you're going to talk.
This is for travel, yeah. And then food we are doing here. For the most part, except for lunch, because we decided to sort of pool those funds and go out to dinner tonight in lieu of lunch, just because everybody's got different lunch needs and you always end up with piles and piles of food that nobody ends up eating. So we'll have breakfast here every morning at 8:30 to 9. Lunch is on your own. We've got the student union is a very short walk away, and there's a longer walk to Route 1. We can kind of discuss what those options are as we approach lunch around noon. And then there will be a coffee cookie/brownie bites snack at 2 or 3, depending on where we are in our process. And then tonight we're going to dinner at Franklin's, which is a local restaurant. We do need to drive there. So what we can do is a bunch of us have cars. We're breaking today at around 5. The reservation is for 6:45. So we can pick everybody up at the hotel around 6:30. If we can all just meet, we'll decide where we plan to meet at the end of the day. There's plenty of room. I've got a really large van, so I might have. If you're feeling insecure in the seats, I've also got car seats, so I can buckle you down. All right, I think that's it for the. And then everyone is wireless recording. We have, I think, 2 computers going.
3, actually, yeah, which was the cause of the squealing earlier.
Yeah, 3 computers going. We'll be putting up eventually your slides and audio alongside the recommendations. The way this is, we foresee this working, is today we're basically sort of all talking about our various places, discussing at the end of the day what we want to do tomorrow. Tomorrow we're basically going to try and sort of pack at these recommendations. The process is both public and private. We expect everybody to, we want everyone to sign off on what we put out there before we put it out there, so don't feel as if anything is if you say it or give it to us, it's not beyond your reach. You'll just have to be attentive to actually sign off on what your parts are. We'll have someone editing the sound files afterwards so that you can see where various bits are that pertain to you in your presentation. so that you can actually so go to those links. And if you could tell us a timestamp, Doug's going to get into that issue. One thing we are going to do is after today, as sort of a first hack at the recommendations, after tomorrow, we'll put, Doug and I will revisit the document, incorporate what we've talked about the last few, these few days. We will put the document up again for our viewing to do additional editing if people want to add stuff. And then eventually it's going to go on comment press and media commons so that when we're happy with our sort of recommendations, the rest of the community can come in and make comments or it's very much, we want it to be very much a public and collaborative document. So that's pretty much the timing. And all of this, the editing, et cetera, in terms of our group will happen over the next couple of months. And we hope it to have it probably for public consumption by, I think, early summer. Is that right?
Yep.
Late spring, something like that. So what I'm going to do is sort of some opening remarks just to sort of get us grounded in what we're doing. And then we'll do some, Doug's going to talk about the privacy public issues. And then we'll do some introductions around the table just to make sure that everybody knows who we are and where we're coming from. So in our grant proposal, which I won't rehearse here in its entirety, we start with a little bit of history about the role that digital humanity centers play as crucial seedbeds of innovation, a description that John Unsworth and others use in our cultural commonwealth, cyber infrastructure for the humanities and social sciences, the report of the Commission on Cyber Infrastructure at the American Council of Learned Societies. With this report in mind, we note that digital humanities centers, quote, have been historically positioned to take the lead in scholarly innovation and disciplinary transformation. Their ultimate function at the present time, and this is a quote from our narrative, is not just to help set the agenda for the new humanities to come, but to work in practical ways to help bring this transformation about. And this is what we think this sort of workshop and these recommendations are about. You all are presenting a lot of different entities in the university and DH centers. And like I said, we're here to do this collaboratively. One way we think to sort of make this practical transformation is to be more transparent about the kinds of labors that go on in digital humanities centers and how that work does and does not fit into standard modes of professionalization and promotion in the academy. That said, our primary goal over the next day and a half is to sketch out recommendations that address the sometimes ambiguous career trajectories that greet staff at digital humanities centers. To this end, we propose that our recommendations would have two main sections. There we go. Defining and evaluating scholarship in digital humanities centers, so talking about research and service and what that means. And then secondly, which is clearly contentious in the comments and in the document, is standardizing positions and titles. That is clearly something up for debate. This is a collaborative document, and we can revisit that and rework it as we see it to be more useful. So I'd like to just spend a couple minutes unpacking the overall goal for a few minutes before Doug starts us on a conversation about these two sections. As I wrote to many of you when asking for descriptions of how you are staffing your emergent, and established centers, our main goal here is about personnel issues, but what quickly becomes transparent is how quickly they become personal issues as well. We know that the conversation over the next couple of days will be fruitful but also difficult since it is about what we both love to do, but also what we are paid to do. We all know that labor goes on in digital humanities centers is not easily definable into neat and dry paper package sticks that are flavored research or service or associate director or assistant director. It is an amalgam of flavors, a sticky ball of chewed gum. It can be both unappetizing in conversation as well as extremely difficult to digest. Clearly, this metaphor could drag on ad nauseum.
No!
And it's not even a very good one, even with all my advanced degrees. But it does point to the sticky part of the story. This is about labor and paying for labor on some level, and it feels messy and somehow extraneous in the elevated world of higher learning. This idea that considering labor is innovative is in fact untrue. It's done in the sciences and libraries and in museums. It's done less in the humanities, as we've all come to realize. The digital humanities is like but unlike other humanities disciplines. In the digital humanities, scholars do work in centers that is different from what is normally do the kind of work in centers that is different from what is normally counted for promotion in traditional humanities departments. At the same time, which is what I think makes this particularly difficult, and which is most alarming for some, DH centers are doing the work that is similar, if not the same, as what's going on in departments, but this work is not even being counted for promotion or tenure there. As a result, people are upset about what it means to do digital humanities. None of this clearly is new news to many of you in the room, but this general conversation about identity politics is important when we consider our audience for these recommendations. John Unsworth said in his address, The State of Digital Humanities 2010, to the Digital Humanities Summer Institute in June, it's difficult to achieve or grant tenure when opinions are divided, and it's in these discussions about tenure that faculty and departments confront their own identity politics most directly. Every time you affirm that some new person belongs in your pantheon, you are saying something about both tradition and individual talent, and you are redefining your own professional commitments and rearticulating your vision of the future of your discipline. And I think John is saying something very important about our conversation here. We will certainly tackle over the next day and a half our own identity politics and a redefinition of our own professional commitments concerning who is in and who is out of DH, and whether coding or not coding, building or breaking it down, new media or old humanities computing is the currency in this field. But I would like to propose that we define our pantheon first, which is digital humanities centers. Issues concerning promotion in this space is about digital humanities centers. Is for current or soon-to-be staff at digital humanities centers and the administrators to whom they are of concern. So this is what I'm recommending for these recommendations, is that we keep our minds set in this particular space. Tenure and promotion committees in disciplinary departments may see useful definitions here in the work that we're doing that can help them evaluate the work of tenure-track colleagues in their departments, but I would like to propose that they are not our specific audience. Those recommendations that they would design are best when tailored for their own disciplinary concerns. Beyond the question of audience, I'd like to bring up two more issues that are of concern as we work to create our two sections on defining research and scholarship in DH centers and on defining roles in DH centers. The first question is the doozy. What counts in a DH center as work? In terms of defining the work that happens and is countable in DH centers, I would like to reintroduce what Tom Scheinfeld is called the third way. In his October 2nd, 2008 blog post, Making It Count Toward a Third Way, Tom writes about Mills Kelly's series of blog posts. And Mills Kelly is a historian, tenured historian in the history department at George Mason. And Tom, if I may sort of paraphrase what he was saying, he talks about Kelly's blog post, Making Digital Scholarship Count, in which Kelly argues that if scholars want digital scholarship to count in traditional promotion and tenure decisions, then they have to make sure it conforms to the characteristics and standards of traditional scholarship. Essentially, Tom discusses how Mills, as tenured professor in the history department, makes a distinction between, quote, digital scholarship and other kinds of digital work, the first which bears the characteristics of traditional scholarship and the second which does not. The first should count as scholarship, in Kelly's terms, in promotion and tenure decisions. The second should not, this idea of scholarship versus work. Rather, it should count as service or something similar. This is Tom speaking about Mills's definitions. But then Tom goes on, as we say in literary studies, to complicate this polarity. He says, I more or less agree with this, and I'm fine with Mills' distinction. Communities have the right to set their own standards and decide what counts as this or that. Tom also accepts that he, quote, does relatively little work that would fit traditional definitions of scholarship. At the same time, and this is the quote I have up on the screen, I'm not willing to accept the second-class status of, for instance, an adjunct faculty member. My work, whether it is scholarship or not, wins awards, attracts hundreds of thousands of dollars in grant funding, turns up periodically on CNN and the New York Times, enables the work of hundreds of other academics, and is used every day by thousands of people, scholars and non-scholars alike. That may not make it tenurable, but it's certainly not second class. My work requires a third way. Tom's third way caused quite a stir, not only because it touched a nerve, but it was one of the first and loudest heard declarations that non-tenure trackism was not leprosy. In fact, it could be quite nice. Bethany Novisky calls her job as director of digital research and scholarship at UVA Library, quote, a pretty sweet gig, and her January 3rd, 2010 posting, Alt-Ac, Alternate Academic Careers for Humanities Scholars. The sweet spot, she notes, is, quote, in the satisfaction of making teams and systems and programs work. And I'm sort of bringing all this up because clearly we're going to be talking about this kind of work. of solving problems and personally making or enabling breakthroughs in research and scholarship in our disciplines, and of contributing to and experiencing the life and mind in ways we did not imagine when we entered grad school. I think this is particularly poignant, and Bethany has gone on to pull together a host of writings by what she calls alt-act scholars in a collection that will appear in the spring on Media Commons. And so I think this actually will be a nice complement mm-hmm. to that edition as well. Clearly, there are many, many sides to this, perspectives that place the work that digital humanities centers do within the arena of more traditional humanities studies. Steve Ramsey and his blog on building, which he just wrote a couple weeks ago after MLA, there's always a flurry of this sort of defining digital humanities after MLA. It doesn't happen after DH. Imagine that, but it happens after MLA. Personally, Steve says, I think digital humanities is about building things. DHers insist again and again that this process of creation yields insights that are difficult to acquire otherwise. It's the thing I've been hearing for as long as I've been in this. People who mark up text say it as those who build software, hack social networks, create visualizations, and pursue dozens of other forms of haptic engagement that bring DHers to the same table. And I like that impression. Digital humanities centers to me, and part of this is my experience at Myth, has always been that coming to the table. All of those different minds actually coming to the table and working together. Building is for us a new kind of hermeneutic, one that is quite a bit more radical than taking the traditional methods of humanistic inquiry and applying them to digital objects. In a less recent post by Jeffrey Walkwell, which he calls a work in progress, and he's very clear on this, it's a work in progress, and he last updated it in June 2010, and it's also, Ramsey quotes it as well in his, but I think it's the last of this sort of what is this kind of work we're doing that I want to bring up here. He also talks about the importance of folks who are building project teams and project workflows, so project managers. We should be clear, he writes, about the importance of project management and thing knowledge, the tacit knowledge of fabrication and its cultures, even if the very nature of that poesis, knowledge of making itself cannot easily and shouldn't have to be put into words. We should be able to welcome theoretical perspectives without fear of being swallowed in postmodernisms that are exclusive as our craft knowledge. I like that idea of craft knowledge. Clearly, these conversations are important in light of our discussion today, since we need and want to know our audiences. I am proposing that we are talking to digital humanities centers, and others may use these recommendations and expand on them in terms of their own pantheon. If we are talking to digital humanities centers, however, our two sections still remain. How do we count the kind of work that Tom, Bethany, Steve, and Jeffrey claim is our purview? How do we at all, define the worth of labor in digital humanities centers, that is coding and encoding, building and project managing, theorizing and critiquing, plus more and about a third way for rewarding this work in the life of the mind? So I want to conclude this longish introduction with my last question, which is more subtle but more direct and should be in the backs of our minds as we begin. What can we accomplish in this document? What do we think is the desired outcomes of these recommendations? What can we offer from our perspectives in digital humanities centers? One thing we can offer is clearly transparency about who staffs DH centers, what these folks do, how labor is currently divided, evaluated, and funded for folks who want to roll their own, for folks who want to join the game, and for folks who are in the game and want to, in a mashup of Unsworth's words, rearticulate their vision of the future. Clearly, transparency doesn't show that these labors are people's lives and their loves. Certainly, systematically pulling out sticky bits and thumbprinting them down onto org charts is not a useful or productive sole objective. But then our last question that's important for us over the next day and a half is, how do we define our professional commitments and rearticulate our vision for the future of digital humanities centers in this itty-bitty little document? So I think we are going to... Do you want to talk about privacy first, or should we go right into introductions?
Yeah, let's do privacy first. So, as Tanya said, and I think as many have tweeted, these conversations have the potential to be, I think, somewhat potentially heated and at least very tied to, I think, our own individual careers and individual passions. As a result, I think it would be good if we limited tweeting to the actual formal presentations. We, I think, can assume that those formal presentations are intended for public consumption. If you don't feel that, make a note of that, I suppose, at the beginning, that you'd prefer people not tweet this. But I think it would be good if we could at least assume that the things that are presented up at the podium are tweetable. The discussions, I think it would be good if we mutually agreed that we won't tweet in the discussions. I think the one exception to that, and we can talk about this in a minute, is if you want to make your own observation about the state of the field or the discussions without necessarily quoting somebody else. I think that seems like that might be okay if you say, you know, I'm thinking this, but not Neil said this, and isn't that funny or whatever.
Isn't that funny?
Or also people have a different idea about this. Right. I mean, we can also table this.
Yeah.
We can discuss this.
We should discuss that in the first discussion. This is just our kind of proposal. We are recording from three different stations. I'm trying to figure out the best way to pull something off the record. If you want it, the one way that we will certainly do is if you say something and then, you know, we're going to do a limited release of the recordings to everyone in the room first so you can listen to them, make sure there's nothing that you really need taken out.
Or if you're sitting here, you just said something and you're like, ooh, I don't know that I like that I just said that.
Right,
so
that's a slightly different issue. So the distributing it, hearing something and taking it out. The problem is that that's fairly time consuming to do, so we don't mind doing it for a couple people, but it would be good if we had an idea of what we want to take out before we distribute it. So if you do say something or you're about to say something that you want off the record, running around to each of these computers and turning them off is probably going to be impractical. So I think along those lines, I'm just say that I'm going to press this gong sound. The gong sound, which I'll probably press somewhere else, or not turn on the thing on this one, is or some sound that will be distinctive on the recording that we can search the audio file and say, something was said at this point, so we can automate some of that pulling out.
That one's going to call all dogs, and we're going to have a problem.
Okay. Maybe we can do a whistle or something like that. Anyway, something that will be distinctive that I'll find out.
Do you have a running time clock?
I do, but they won't be the same on each one is the problem. In any case, yes. So if you could make sure that you mention that you've just said something or you want something taken out, we'll sound some sort of effect and then pull those out automatically.
So just so we understand, everything's recorded all the time.
Everything is recorded all the time.
And if we know we're going to say something, we could just say off the record or something like that. Use this gong sound.
Right.
Or if you've said something.
That's
good to know.
Right. And if somehow we miss it or you think of it later on, we'll let you hear the recordings. But, you know, if we have to remove 50 different things, that'll take our grad student or whoever is doing this a long time.
I think
that is all. Do we want to talk about those right now or do you want to come back to those?
Talk about
these policies.
Does anyone have any other thoughts or ideas about that? About privacy versus public nature of these conversations and how to manage. Let's just say what we want. Okay,
never mind. We're going to do that anyway.
Yeah.
Our institutions would like it.
The unedited recording? That's a good question. I guess we can
destroy it.
Yeah.
Put it online somewhere.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. That we should think about later on.
What are you going to do with the unedited?
Yeah, the unedited one. I mean, I guess we're going to... Yeah, I mean, we'll listen to it as we're writing our recommendations and, you know we'll check people out. So I guess we can just destroy the unedited recording afterward. That's probably the best way to do it.
What do you guys think? I think that's fine.
Or you could leave it in an archive to be uncovered after we're all
in 100 years, right?
Bury it.
I'm sort of unprepared for this question because I actually hadn't imagined, but I should have, I suppose, that one might be saying things that would be so dangerous if heard that they would, you know, potentially harm oneself or one's colleagues in the room. But maybe now I should...
You could easily, I mean, we're going to be talking about personnel issues.
About
cases which would have enough detail attached to them, even if you didn't name names, that people could identify those individuals if they had any conflict.
Yeah. Personnel, institutional policies, budgets, any of that could come up. And that's very worrying to me. I wouldn't want my institution hearing.
So the policy is there to make sure that those details do make it into our conversation.
That's what we hope.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or, I mean, we could think about this. We could have the recording on as we're doing these sort of presentations today we could turn it off for periods of time when we know we're just...
Yeah, the problem is that we don't have that built into the schedule right now. What do you think? Actually, Jason, could you just say something? I want to see if you get picked up on this one.
Say something so you can see if I...
Perfect. Okay, yeah, that's exactly what I wanted. Okay, so that means that everybody's getting picked up. We'll just use one recording.
You're going to need that data
that was
for your synthesis.
Yeah, we do need the, Julie's saying, we're going to need this data for our synthesis, because as fast as I can try. Yeah, we'll just, you just trust us that we'll destroy it and not disseminate it.
Use it as background for the writing on the document.
Yeah. I will put my own reputation on the line here and say we will destroy it.
It'll be a hellfire of scandal if
that's
you do
right.
not.
Okay.
So I'm actually stopping the other two recordings. There will only be one. We'll dispense with the gong sound and just stop mine.
That's better.
Yeah. Okay.
Stop one.
If he's only got one recording going, then he
can just stop
it.
Yeah.
Right. That would be great.
Okay, good. Yeah. All right, so we have some consensus.
You may want to shut that door, though.
Yeah.
So if someone says off the record, he'll just press pause.
Yeah, right.
And we will... nothing to destroy later.
Are there any questions about that, or Doug, do you have anything else to say?
I don't think so. I think the tweeting thing is the other thing we should agree on.
Okay.
Everyone thinks that's good. The tweeting public is fine, tweeting conversations not so much, unless you are just making your own observation and not saying anything, not attributing anything to anyone else.
Do you have additional? Yeah.
Maybe we can revisit this issue after the day's conversation.
Sure.
See what the feeling is after we've heard what's been said.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. That sounds great.
One other thing I'd say about tweeting is that if a reference to something online emerges, I mean, that's often what happens in conversations like this, and you just want to share a link to a document that's somewhere out there.
Yeah, I think anything that's public online, you should be able to tweet too.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can all use our own discretion. So not tweeting isn't necessarily what we're saying, but just sort of using your sort of judgment about what you're tweeting.
Yeah.
I think we can all figure that out. So any last... comments or thoughts about that? Okay. So I thought we would go around the room and talk about this. Some people know everybody in the room. Some people don't know anybody in the room. I think everybody knows somebody in the room. So what we'd like to do in lieu of name tags is introductions, very brief, because a lot of the stuff you're going to go over in the sort of short presentations you're doing later today. So really we're just looking at your name, your affiliation, your role at your institution or center. And these are more difficult questions. So if you could be very sort of brief, we just want to put this out there because it would be nice for everyone to know where everyone is coming from in terms of this conversation, is why are you interested in this conversation? And these are purposefully vague. So read these questions as you want to read them, or read them in, you know, following behind your neighbor who's just read them a certain way if you'd like. Why are you interested in this conversation? And then finally, what do you think must be included in these recommendations before the end of these 2 days? Yeah, so these are difficult. And I'm going to actually take notes on some of these the last one particularly, just so I can make sure that we have sort of a touch point. And it can be brief. It doesn't have to be everything you want to include. But if there's something you've seen in the document that's not there, that you think should be included, or you can just say, I agree with K, or, you know, whatever works. I guess we'll start. I've been talking a lot, so I won't start. Maybe we'll start with Paul.
You want me to start?
Sure.
Are you sure?
Yeah, we'll go around.
I'm the one
that
most of the fewest number of people in the room know. So maybe that is logical. Hi, I'm Paul Marty. I'm an associate professor in the Library Science Program at Florida State University. I'm delighted to be here. We're in the middle of, we have an emerging digital humanities center coming online at Florida State that cuts across 4 different colleges now. So I was delighted to be invited to come here and learn from the expertise and the experiences that you all have had, which is why I'm interested in this conversation. I feel a little hesitant answering question number 4 being the first one. I enjoyed reading all the conversations on the Google Docs. I intentionally avoided posting some of my own thoughts, again, being sort of new to some of these conversations. But one thing that I might just say here is that I see a lot of parallels in these distinctions with a lot of other centers and places that I've been involved with. One of the research projects I'm on now is an NSF-funded VOS project, Virtual Organizations of Social Systems, and we're studying the researchers at the National High Magnetic Field Laboratory in Tallahassee, Florida,
If you don't know this about Tallahassee, Florida, the world's most powerful magnets are located in Tallahassee, Florida. I didn't know this when I moved to Tallahassee. It apparently is one of the reasons that Tallahassee hasn't been hit by a hurricane in 20 years. It's not true.
In a plane, mysteriously crashed.
Right, exactly.
It's not really the Bermuda Triangle.
No, no, but they have a 45 Tesla magnet, which is pretty impressive. And so in this project, we've been studying the collaborative activities of the scientists there. And one of the things that has really shown up as a key issue is that they have staff, non-tenure track, what they call scholar scientists, who work full-time there at the Mag Lab, who support research scientists who come in from all around the world to use those facilities. At the same time, however, they're trying to conduct their own research. They move their own agendas forward in the physics areas in which they work. And that relationship can be very collaborative. It can be fraught with tension. And I think a lot of the things that we see happening there parallel some of the conversations that I see happening on the document here.
Great. I'm Julia Flanders, and I'm at Brown University as part of the Center for Digital Scholarship in the Brown University Library. And I direct the Women Writers Project, which is one component of the Center for Digital Scholarship. And I think I have some incipient title, like Associate Director or something at the CDS as well. I'm interested in the conversation because I've always been interested in sort of the labor politics of the digital humanities or humanities computing, because my own career has been so kind of much a tour of all the different possible ways that you could be employed. So thinking about work and what work is and what different kinds of work there are and how they're compensated and how they're instantiated in outputs and how they interact with one another and so forth has always just fascinated me as a topic. I think I'm less invested in the word scholarship than I am in the word work. So that is sort of where I'm coming from here. And I think that will probably influence how I feel about the recommendations, but I'm sort of agnostic about what kinds of recommendations are appropriate for this group, so I'm looking forward to hearing more.
Hi, I'm Laura Mandel. I work at Miami University of Ohio, not Florida. I wish it were Florida. And I am here because, not because I have a center, and we nominally have a center there, but because I'm director of 18th Connect and associate director of Nines, and technological editor for Romantic Circles, and these are all organizations devoted to trying to give credit for digital work to traditional faculty who are on the tenure track primarily. I think I'm here by way of contrast, or by way of thinking through those issues. My fascination with this topic comes from two kinds of research that I'm currently involved in working on. One is the hidden work that goes on in creating books that that if it were, you know, sort of studied ethnographically would shed some light on why there is a knee-jerk denigration of certain kinds of work going on in collaboratory settings. The other is the postmodern distaste for craft knowledge, which to me emerges around 1700 when the poetics manuals start to be replaced by discourses about aesthetics. And so I'm interested in the history of this, and that's all I'll say.
I'm Steve Jones. I'm at Loyola University Chicago, where I'm in the English department, but also co-director of a brand-new-year-old Center for Textual Studies and Digital Humanities, which actually lives between and among the various institutions. I'll talk about that later. So I'm interested in learning. I'm here to sort of learn from the established people, but also to sort of watch as our conversations emerge for opportunities for the larger community to provide areas of advocacy and advice for me to take back to my administrators and my colleagues. And I'll say I've been involved in Romantic Circles, you know, with Neil and Laura. And through Romantic Circles, we're lucky to be involved also with Nines. And so there's a whole kind of network of issues of content creation and publication, and then the vetting that goes on that translates into what people's labor counts for in various kinds of positions that we've all been involved in.
I'm Brian Croxall. I'm currently a clear postdoc at Emory's Woodruff Library. And we are currently building, under a Mellon Planning Grant, Digital Scholarship Commons. And so that's part of why I'm interested in this conversation, is we're at this sort of stage that I know a couple others are at, where we're trying to start something new and figure out how we can lay out the plans for the people we're going to be hiring. And my other interest is I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do for a job for the rest of my life. So working these issues out is personal for me as well. And I think if I had, you know, what I think must be included, although I don't know that it would be possible, but I think it would be really valuable to come to sort of a sense of agreement about what we would like to see these definitions or be, what that might be, I have no idea. Well, or I can riff off of what we've already been doing, but if it were possible for us to agree on something, I think it could be very valuable. We'll see if we can get the 20 of us to do that and then take it back.
Should we go around to John?
Hi, I'm John Unsworth. I'm the Dean of the Graduate School of Library and Information Science at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Special breathing training. I've been involved in digital humanities for a long time, ran a center in Virginia before I went to Illinois, and one of the attractions at Illinois was actually that I think library and information science programs are some of the best established training grounds for people with an interest in having a digital humanities profession. So you're that, for those reasons, all of those reasons, I guess.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jason Rohde. I'm a senior program officer in the Office of Digital Humanities at the National Endowment for the Humanities. I'm interested in this conversation because it was funded through our office, but also because I have a great interest in sort of the alt-ac and just professionalization issues in general. I mean, I have to say that the Google Doc that you all put together, the descriptions, and I hope the conversation today, I think will give us a better understanding of all the issues that you're grappling with, which will help us in turn, you know, adjust our funding priorities and programs to better support the work that we do. So thanks so much for what you've already done. I'm looking forward to hearing the conversation.
Hi, I'm David Miller from the University of South Carolina. I am the director of a newly established Center for Digital Humanities there, and I'm interested in this conversation, I guess in a way you could say, because I'm trying to figure out my own job description. As director of the center, I'm responsible for recruiting staff, and that means that on the one hand, I'm responsible to the institution for their job performance, and on the other hand, I represent the face of the institution for them as regards the rewards and the conditions of their labor, and I feel a tremendous sense of personal responsibility to the people that I have recruited to work in that center. Right now, the situation is very unstable for everyone in an academic institution economically. I feel like this is a critical moment for me and for people like the people who work for me. And I'm aware in a broader context that although universities consider themselves to be angels of light and progressive politics in many ways, institutionally their own labor practices are less than utopian. And so I don't have any list of things that I think have to be included in these recommendations before the end of 2 days. I'm mostly here to learn from the rest of you, but I have some real urgent concerns that I hope you all will help me work through in these conversations.
Good morning, I'm David Seaman. I'm the Associate Librarian for Information Management at Dartmouth College. I think I'm here partly because I've rattled around this space for a while. I next door to John for, mm-hmm. for 10 years ran the Electronic Tech Center at UVA in 1992 to 2002. Then I got better. to other things in the digital library world at the Digital Library Federation, and now AUL position at Dartmouth. So I suspect I'm here partly because I used to run a centre and now I've got some other other lenses to look at all of this through a humanities bent academically. I would hope that the other thing that I've been following closely as a recipient as well as a follower and a reviewer is the move into digital humanities in the grant space. So it's the NIH here, IMLS has made similar moves, even NSF, as many of you know, funded in our space, which I think is very helpful. I hope the recommendations, I understand why you want to center this in centers to limit the scope, but there's probably at least as much digital humanities work that isn't center-based, so I'm not looking to bust the scope, but I would urge us to be mindful of the fact that this ought to make sense. Mm-hmm. In a setting like Dartmouth, where we have a long-standing, richly endowed centre for humanities, as many places do, it's not a digital centre, but it's interesting and innovative. We have a chair in digital humanities, which isn't a centre-based thing, it's an endowed academic chair. It's actually attached to the studies that we do, the game thing. Many other things. That's very high profile. And we have an emerging digital humanities structure that is an amalgam, for faculty support in particular, it's an amalgam of computing and library operations in a support team. So yeah, there's a non-centers set a place that's got a fair amount of investment and activity, and I suspect is poised to make some more investments, but probably not in the center. I would hope too that as we look at this, we remind ourselves that the recommendations need to be institutionally aware and sophisticated. They need to make sense to my provost, not just my English department. Okay? But we tend to bolt ourselves to the departments we know and love, which rarely are centres of power in our institutions. So in fact, some of the models we may want to stumble towards for the way we operate in the centres, we find readily in the science and technology and medicine areas where the department has almost disappeared. That's our provost just last week, who was a biologist, was talking about the dissolution of the department structure of Dartmouth in those areas. And there's lots of great models for interdisciplinary work there that we almost entirely lack in the humanities. And then finally, of course, as I'm in libraries and been in libraries since the early days of the ETEC Centre, I hope, probably along with John, be a voice for the library, not just as a host in their basements, or as just as a training pool. And we've seen many folks come out of library-based settings, some of them in this room, have gone to greatness. But also for labour and funding lessons. We tend to have very well worked out professional ladders that mirror academic ones. When they don't literally be, some of them literally are academic ones. And these are long-standing, they work very well, and I suspect they'd be good at analogs to look at very closely.
Mm-hmm. I'm Bethany Nabisky. I'm the Director of Digital Research and Scholarship for the University of Virginia Library System, and I'm also Associate Director of SCI, the Scholarly Communication Institute, which is a Mellon-funded sort of annual think tank. I am interested in the conversation because SCI is engaging increasingly with issues of professionalization in the digital humanities, and personally, and in my role at the Scholars Lab at UVA Library, I'm editing the ALDAC collection and working with many graduate students who see themselves as pursuing an alternate academic sort of career path, and they are making it up as they go along, as many of us did, and looking to the centers that they're working with to sort of help define those paths for them. I'm also working within the library and on our general faculty council at UVA in a time when our HR structures across the university are being, realigned. There is some erosion and consolidation of, we've had a plethora of non-tenure track and library faculty formally defined roles, and many of those are being consolidated as we move to a new university staff system that is a more flexible alternative to the classified staff system that we sort of inherited from the state. So we're thinking through what are the best sort of qualities and situations for those roles that we want to preserve, and which are the ones that really could move over into staff roles, and therefore how do we sort of redefine staff roles to make them more productive and more flexible, and to offer more more alternatives for people and paths to growth. At the same time that some of those classifications are eroding, we're also at UVA paying more attention to hybrid career paths for scholar technologists, and sort of specifically looking at people who have deep training in one or more academic disciplines, but also are performing what has typically been called work at the university. So there's all that going on at home. In terms of what I think we must include in these recommendations, as I read the document as it stands, I think we need to recognize that many centers are embedded in larger systems that shape the formal definitions of faculty and staff roles. So we may be able, you know, Brian calls for sort of the ideal picture of how these career paths should be defined, maybe what they should be called, et cetera. But that's going to play out very differently if you are a center that reports independently to the provost versus a center that is actually, like mine, a department of the library. So there's that to think about.
I'm Steve Olson. I'm the Associate Director of Research and Manager of Digital Activities at the Modern Language Association. I'm also co-liaison for the MLA Committee on Information Technology, which is largely why I'm here. The CIT, which is that committee, has been very interested in issues of evaluating work in digital media for tenure and promotion over many years now. Has several documents that have become official MLA documents. They're in the process of reviewing and revising those documents, so I'm very interested in the issue of evaluation. The MLA has a longstanding concern with conditions of work for people in the humanities, and I'm very much interested in hearing what the circumstances are at your local institutions. In terms of what must be included, I think I want to follow up on the last two comments, which are one, I think whatever recommendations you make have to be flexible, not only to match the institutional circumstances of these centers, but also to match the various interests and desires of the people doing this work. I'm hearing lots of different reports from people working in digital humanities about whether they want tenure line faculty positions or not. And I think that's a very interesting issue we should keep in mind.
Oh, sure. I'm Tom Scheinfeld. I'm Managing Director of the Center for History and New Media at George Mason. I am interested in this conversation because I manage 45 or 50 people who fall into this category of alt-ac, I guess, who are doing amazing and innovative work in the digital humanities. And I spend most of my time scrambling around making sure that there's money to keep that work going. And I think having some clarity in terms of institutional roles, professional identities would make the business of keeping all that great work going easier and facilitate more of it. I think I'll say more about this in my little presentation, but I guess, and I think this, from what I've heard, this group is definitely on the same page. What I wouldn't like this conversation to be about, and what I don't think the report should be about, is about tenure. I think that needs to play a role in this conversation, but I fear that so many of these conversations, actually so many of any conversation about digital humanities, devolves into a conversation about tenure and promotion. And I think that conversation can be a dangerous distraction for this group. I mean, and it's a dangerous distraction when you're talking about, nines. It's a dangerous distraction when you're talking about, Zotero. We fall into that trap a lot, and I hope we don't fall into it here. The other thing I'd say is I would echo the things that Paul and David have said, that the sciences have been dealing with these questions for an awful long time. I just tweeted a link to an article by Stephen Chapin, The Invisible Technician, which describes labor relations in the sciences between technical staff and sort of scholars, going back to the 17th century, and they've come up with some interesting models for dealing with these questions. And I think we have a lot to learn, especially since our field, at least borrows a lot of technology and a lot of ways of working from the sciences. I think we have a lot. There's a lot there, and I hope that we can explore those avenues, and I hope that the report can explore those.
Thanks. Just interrupt for 1 second. The hashtag is tracks for hacks. So TRX for HX.
TRX number four.
Yeah. TRX number four HX. So if you have a link and you want to throw that on there, that'd be helpful because that way I can find it afterwards as well.
I'm Mark Cabot. I run, developed the Center for Public History and Digital Humanities at Cleveland State University. I'm interested in this conversation for several reasons. One is I had an alt-ac career after I finished my dissertation back in the 90s, and it was actually in public history and museum studies. And so I think sometimes we imagine this digital humanities conversation is suddenly new. And I think there have been alt-ac tracks for a very long time, public history, museum studies, and I think we could all come up with a host of other examples. And the process of trying to invent yourself and reinvent yourself, I think, is a really challenging issue for scholars, for digital folks, for public historical types. I also happen to write a book about firefighting, and I think firefighters are a better model for digital humans, better than at least the gum. they're heroic.
The bar is low.
They're heroic. I wrote a book about how firefighting emerged as a profession, and it was about a process of reinvention. And one of the words that we might want to use is the word jurisdiction. In this kind of sociology of occupation, the question of jurisdiction is really important, and it can apply in local settings. It can apply in broader cultural societal settings. It often follows money. One of the things I've noted around the table is everybody either has a source of funding or has developed a source of funding. And funding is part of that jurisdictional battle, right? How you carve out space. And when you're developing a career as an alt-ac, if you can find a champion, if you can bring in money, if you're at, as I am, a second-tier institution, you can develop the center if you have money, right? And I actually, so I think I'm here in part because I'm in this kind of second-tier state institution. I'm like the kid at the adults table today. In the sense that second-tier institutions are often left out of this, right? Mm-hmm. Second-tier state institutions. I mean, Cleveland State is not Miami of Ohio. If you're in Ohio, it's, there are some good universities. It's Ohio State and Miami, right? And then the rest of the state institutions, which is actually where more students are being trained, where this kind of work is happening. And so one of the questions I think we really need to come up with or address is how does digital humanities make its way to these places? It will. And they'll look to the conversations like this for identity, for ways to carve out that space. And again, public history museum studies is the example. Lots of people are trained in public history museum studies, most of them not at the large institution. Finally, just a couple notes of things I didn't see. One is I think sometimes we think alt-ac, having had a job in industry for a while, an alt-ac career is very similar to that. Academic institutions provide very stable employment patterns. In the real world, that just doesn't exist, right? So in some ways, some of the things I think we worry about, we might not need to worry about, right? And Tom and I, actually one of the things Tom and I have talked about in the past is, I'm responsible for just a few people, but you're responsible for 45, and one of our jobs is to help them develop careers, right? And that is actually that's, I think, the hardest thing we do, because we eventually really start to care about them. You know, we've been raising money for them. How do we help them develop careers? And I think that's one of my interests here, is how do we help our colleagues develop careers? I don't see a lot of, everybody talks about the programmer in digital humanities, but who talks about the designer? Design matters. Designers have great careers. And then finally, I think Tom's right about the science, looking to the sciences for models of what to do. I also think we should look to them for models of what not to do. The long-term postdoc is the, as the producer of research for a scholar, I think, is not a way we want to go. But anyway, so those are just some kind of random thoughts.
I'm Neil Freistadt, and I'm a professor of English here at the University of Maryland, and I direct MIST. I co-direct CenterNet, an international network of digital humanities centers. So my interest in this session is twofold. On the one hand, it's just about very practical, even nuts and bolts issues for directors of centers and what practically we can do to help our staff develop and to have productive careers. I'll just go along that track a little bit, because my experience of digital humanities centers in general has been that we're all very improvisational places. We make ourselves up as we go along, and that's partly a function of the staff that we have. That's partly a function of all the institutional material realities around us, and it often doesn't leave a space for kind of reflected transformations. You know, having a space to step back and reflect upon our practices, think about good paths forward, and then put it out there so other people can share the benefit of that reflection, I think is really important. And I've been directing MIST now for about 6 years, and it was already a thriving center when I came into it. And found myself, though, feeling very much that I had at least part of a staff that were like round pegs trying to fit into square holes. And that's, on the one hand, a problem for DH centers in that it creates instability in your staffing. And it's a problem on the other hand, because your staff can't find positions that are truly fulfilling for them. So we've been trying to think a little bit about how to change that myth. But the resources to help one think through those issues are not readily at hand. So one of the things I would like to see come out of this is actually a bibliography of resources so that people who are trying to think through these issues can, you know, see where our thoughts have come from and have their own. Unfiltered by what we have to say.
That's great.
Maybe I'll just stop there with the final thing that we're starting to echo each other, and that's probably a good thing. But there has to be this dialectic between the changes we want and the material realities that we face if what comes out of this is going to have any force in the world.
I'm Kay Walter. I'm a professor in the university libraries at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and I also co-direct the Center for Digital Research and Humanities with Ken Fries, who is in the College of Arts and Sciences. So we actually report to two different colleges. I guess the reason that I'm interested in this conversation is that as a center director, everything that we do depends on the people that work for us. The other reason really is that one of our stated purposes is to basically help develop the next generation of humanities scholars. But we look at that, and I think in a very broad way. Right now, UNL is going to be starting a graduate level certificate program in digital humanities. And so the issue of alternate career options is very important to us. And if I were to look at people who have, students who have gone through different digital humanities courses at UNL, I would say that there are many different paths for those people. Some of them decide that they want to go into tenure track positions. Some of them end up in publishing. Some of them end up in museums. They're very different ways in which these people can go. And I think that many of them see that as something that is actually very freeing, that they don't have to have a tenure track position necessarily, and they can still thrive in their careers. So I think that that's those are some of the reasons I'm interested in this. And I wanted to kind of go back maybe to what Tom was saying. I don't think we should get hung up on tenure, but in point of fact, for some of us, that is the framework within which we tend to work. So that is going to come up, and I think that we should be okay with that. As far as recommendations for the end of these 2 days, I want to go back to that, the issue of flexibility in job titles. At our institution, any change that would be made in the job title for somebody in an administrative position would have to be approved by 2 deans and the Senior Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs for the center. And for human resources people would have to look at job titles for managerial professionals and office service positions, because certain titles carry certain monetary compensation implications. So I do think that flexibility is sort of important.
Here we go back to Matt. And then.
I'm Matthew Kirschenbaum here at the University of Maryland. I currently have 3 alternating academic careers.
He's had a long time to think.
I've been publishing that one. I'm associate director here at MIT. I'm the director of the Digital Cultures and Creativity Honors Program here on campus, and I'm an associate professor in English. I'm interested in the conversation not only out of those various official or officious capacities, but I've been interested in labor practices in general in the academy for a very long time, going back to my time with the Graduate Student Caucus and the MLA in the 90s. Some of that history was recently very publicly revisited at the MLA convention in Los Angeles. I also remember my very first ACH ALLC conference in Kingston. There was a panel on labor practices in humanities computing, as we then called it, and we were in some vast lecture hall at Kingston, and the room was empty. There were like 6 people in the room, and everyone else was, you know, off doing something else. I think that in terms of what I would, I don't know that I had strong preconceptions in terms of what I want to see in the document or what I think must be in the document. I will say that having been part of several different centers over the course of my career, I'm acutely aware of how important people are and how fragile particular constellations of people are. When a center or a program is working well, when it's firing on all cylinders, everyone knows it, but that's also, it's so fragile, it's so vulnerable, depending on people's comings and goings. So I think for me, one of the takeaways from this conversation and the document would be to see if we can arrive at some ways to not only allow that to happen on a kind of ad hoc basis, but to, you know, to see if we can sort of really think about what makes a center work well and take some practical steps towards institutionalizing that.
Last but not least, I guess we
should. We'll get to.
I'm Suzanne Lodato. I'm with Indiana University, and I'm the co-director of the Institute for Digital Arts and Humanities. I'm also an alt-ac, but a different kind of alt-ac. I was a funder for libraries and scholarly communications for many, many years, both in the private foundation sector and also in the federal government. And I learned about digital humanities that way. So I didn't come at this as somebody trained in programming or somebody who was in library science. I came to it from kind of a higher level of thinking, a broader level of thinking. I took over the Institute a little bit over a year ago on January 1st, 2010. This is a young institute. It was started in 2007. And actually, it was started at the behest of the provost of IU at the time, Michael McRobbie, who's now its president. So unlike some other institutes or centers here, this was an institute that was really mandated from the top level of the university. I'm interested in the conversation today because I am looking at not only how to develop my staff, which has been discussed here, but also how to develop a staff. We have a very, very small group of people. I think we have probably 7 people total on the staff. However, we do partner with other units, as I've talked about in the materials that I submitted for the document, and I guess we'll talk about that more in detail later today. We have no scholar programmers on our staff. I don't think it was conceived of when it was started, the Institute was conceived of when it was started that way, and I don't really see that happening. The original director of the Institute, the founding director, Ruth Stone, was on as director part-time, and I am actually part-time myself as co-director. The other co-director position has not been filled yet. That was intended as a tenured faculty position, but not a position, you know, tenured within the center, but rather they were trying to recruit someone from a department who is already a senior faculty member and who would be brought on a probably a half-time basis. That position has not been filled yet. I am very, very interested, as I said, in looking at how to develop the capabilities of my staff and also how to think about what kind of staff to bring on as we move forward. I'd be very, very interested to see how other centers and institutes here are handling that. As far as recommendations go, I am agnostic as well. I myself am not terribly concerned about pressing on the tenure issue here. As someone in an alternate academic career track myself, you know, I just don't see it as a major issue, but I understand that many other people here do. I'm a lot more interested in looking at how academic non-tenure track positions can be professionalized in these kinds of centers and institutes, because I really think that that's the way we're going, that's the direction that we've been going in. I think that that can be a very, very good direction to go in.
Thank you. I will go. My name is Tanya Clement. I think everyone knows that by now. But my job, so my affiliation is, I am the associate director of an undergraduate program here, which of which Matt is the director, Digital Cultures and Creativity. It's in the Honors College. It is a staff position. I'm a research associate at MIF, and so have enjoyed the conversations at MIF and have a sort of place at MIF. My interest in this conversation began where many of yours began. I found myself increasingly interested with the definitions or the sort of roles and titles that people were sending, and I see those as a very valuable part of this recommendation, the different ways that people are calling the positions at their various institutions is, I think, information that people don't, who are outside of these centers, don't really get to see, and it's not really any place that it's easy to find. And it interests me to have the perspective, have this from your perspective, as opposed to me coming in and saying you have this, and this. I think it's very useful to have you defining it yourself. I think from a personal standpoint, one of the things that I'm interested in this conversation is exposing what people in these alt-ac careers or staff positions, what it is that they want that they're not getting. I'm lucky enough to be in a staff position where my director is allowing me to have time to be on grants, to do some of my own research, money sort of earmarked so that I can go to conferences, things like that, because clearly he sees that as not only good for my own professionalization, but good for the program in which I'm working, but that feels precarious. A new director could come in and decide that that's not well-used money, and then that particular part of my job kind of goes out the window. So there's a way in which that, and that's part of what makes the job enjoyable to me. So I'm very interested in making that kind of conversation. So not necessarily defining titles and roles in a way of whether there's, clearly there's different institutions that have different ways of promoting the work that people do, but really sort of clarifying the fact that a lot of these positions, research is a very important aspect of it. The sort of professional academic aspect of these jobs should be codified in the way that they are done in the university. That's one of the things I'm interested in. And then including in the recommendations, I think, again, I'm very invested in this sort of present state of your centers. I think that's a very important part of the conversation, an important part of these recommendations. So I hope we will probably not spend that much time over the next few days on those. I feel like we've gone back and forth on those a bit. But I do want to make sure that people have looked at those and can add as much information as they possibly think is appropriate to the conversation. I think that would be very useful.
I'm Doug Reeside, and for one more day, I am the Associate Director of the Maryland Institute for Technology and Humanities. Thereafter, I will be the Digital Curator for New York Public Library's Library of the Performing Arts, which is a new position that they've just created this for me, essentially. I'm interested in this conversation for many of the same reasons as Tanya. Leaving MIF was a very, very difficult decision, and one of the reasons that it was so difficult was because I felt that I had all of the advantages, really, of a faculty member, and was able to realize a lot of the my scholarly goals and career goals in an alternative academic, or whatever we want to call it, alt-ac position. Anyway, so 6 months later, I finally made the decision because New York was really too good to pass up, but I also feared during that time that like Tanya, that what was so great about MIF was largely dependent on a very, very supportive supervisory structure in the form of Neil and really all the way up through the deans and that sort of thing. Understanding, like Matt said, though, that constellation is very dependent on personalities, and that was not at all institutionalized in the kind of at the official level job description. Or and I felt could be, could change dramatically with a change in leadership. And while I recognize that that's also true of faculty members, I think that the tenure system and things like that help institutionalize faculty members a little bit more safely than did the sort of position that I was in. So I would hope that out of these discussions come at least the first shift, I guess, to institutionalizing the sort of position that I had at MIF. All right, so you want to move on to the...
I think so. Are people still feeling good? Does anyone want to refresh their coffee or other things?
Yeah, let's take a five-minute
break.
Sure.
Lunch.
Let me pause this real quick.
Meeting is open.
So, Doug, when do you...